Welcome to the podcast of Casper Faith Assembly. This podcast is presented in the context of our Sunday morning service. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
How many of you watched the Super Bowl last week? Boy, wasn't that a wild one. I did not have the opportunity to watch it because part of the reason my wife and I went to Denver is she was going to Phoenix to see her, all of her sisters and her mom. They got down there for a little, sister act. And so I dropped her off at the Phoenix airport, but I had all the radio stations from Denver to Casper that were doing the Super Bowl. I switched stations 5 times to hear the game, and I heard it all the way back. But you know what's really interesting is Nick Foles, he's the backup quarterback. He's a devout Christian, if you didn't know that. And Foles is a devout Christian. And when Carson Wentz went down and the backup was put in, nobody gave the Eagles a chance to win the Super Bowl. Most people didn't even give the Eagles a chance to get to the Super Bowl. They thought they'd be one and done. But I just think it's so neat how God shows that, you know, he can defy what seems impossible, what he seems impossible. God defies the odds, doesn't he? And sometimes you might feel like, well, I'm a backup, or I've got a backup plan. You know, this is not the way I thought things were going to go. Friends, God can take your backup plan, and he can make it a winner. And that's what this series is all about. As we talk about Chase the Lion, we're talking about having God-inspired, God-birthed dreams in our lives, and that we go after them for his glory, for his honor, and for his kingdom. For those of us, you're with us for the first time. Maybe you're not a regular churchgoer. What we want to just say, we are so glad to have you. You are welcome with us here at Casper Faith. And maybe you have questions about God, about Jesus, about the Bible, about spirituality. And if you have questions, we want you to know you're in the right place because we would love to try to answer your questions. And we probably won't have the answers to all of them, but we want to help you in your spiritual journey. And so we welcome you, and you're free to ask questions of us. It's good to have you with us. Now, as we talk about Chase the Lion, I just want to kind of review what we've been talking about the past few weeks. We've talked about that God has these thoughts and these dreams and these plans that are so much higher and bigger and greater than the dreams and plans that we could have. He wants to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or imagine. And the key is to accomplish those dreams. Those dreams many times are beyond our logic, they're beyond our reasoning, they're beyond our abilities, our talents, our resources, and God does that so that when they're accomplished, we don't receive the glory, but he does. And so it takes faith. We need to become people of faith. In the past several weeks, we've been talking about how do we become people of faith so that we can chase the lions God has in store for us. In your notes this morning, we have been focusing on definitions of faith, and we're going to just review for those who missed. Number one, the first definition of faith is faith believes God defies the odds. God is bigger than any problem we'll ever face. The main character we've been looking at this series is Benaiah. He's talked about in 2 Samuel chapter 23. Verses 20 to 23, and he went down into a pit with a lion on a snowy day, and he fought a lion. Now, I don't know about you, but fighting a lion, you know, hand to hand, a mano to a mano, a mane and a lion's mane, that is a pretty impossible thing. You have no weapon, no gun, no shotgun. You know, you're probably going to lose, unless God comes down and intervenes. But that's what God did. God defies the odds, and that's what faith is. Number two, faith is unlearning your fears. All of us have fear. We have to overcome the fear in our life if we're going to chase lions for God. Number three, faith is reframing your problems as opportunities. So many times we see a problem as a problem when really it's a possibility. God gives us a problem because that very problem promotes us. We saw in Benaiah's life, because he took on an Egyptian giant, 7.5 feet tall, because he took on the lion in a pit on a snowy day, because he fought two lion-like warriors of Moab at the same time and he defeated them, those were the events that when King David's looking for a bodyguard, he says, I'm going to make you the head of my bodyguard. Later on, many years later in Israel's history, when Solomon is looking for a commander for the army of Israel, someone to lead all the armies, he remembers that guy. That guy, when he was sitting on his daddy's lap, and he told him about the guy that went down in a pit and fought a lion on a snowy day, he says, that's the guy I want fighting for my army. The things that we see as problems, God uses as promotions. So when you encounter a problem in your life, reframe it and say, God, what are you trying to do? What? Don't get me out of this, God. But what do you want me to get out of it? What do you want to accomplish through this situation in my life? Definition number 4, faith embraces uncertainty because God is in control. A lot of times we want everything to be certain before we'll move. But with faith, faith says, I step out of the boat when I don't see where the tree stump is. How many know Peter did not know where the tree stumps were? How many know there were no tree stumps, right? But that's uncertainty. And if we're going to be people of faith, you have to embrace the uncertainty. Definition number 5, faith is taking risk to seize God-initiated opportunities. And then we have definition number 6 that we're going to focus on today, 6 and 7. Number 6, faith is the willingness to look foolish. How many like to look foolish? Don't really see a single hand here, but that's what faith is. Faith is the willingness to look foolish, because if you're going to defy the odds, if you're going to face your fears, reframe your problems, take risks, and seize God-sized opportunities, you must be willing to look foolish. Fighting a lion without any weapons looks like a pretty foolish thing to do. Taking on 2 lion-like warriors is a pretty foolish thing to do. Fighting a 7.5-foot-tall giant is a foolish thing to do. It's one thing if you're walking through the forest and a lion jumps on you and you start fighting it. It's one thing if 2 lion-like warriors come up to you and take you on, or a giant picks a fight with you. But when you go out and pick the fight with them, that is stupid. I don't care what you say, that's stupid. But here's the thing. We have to be willing to look foolish. I remember when my wife and I first started ministry, we were youth pastors in Salt Lake City. I've shared this story before, but I thought I was going to be a youth pastor for life. And a few years into it, God began to change my heart towards ministering to families and being a senior pastor. And we started looking. We told our senior pastor, he says, will you guys look for a place? We'll look for a youth pastor. And we went several months, and they hadn't found anyone. And we hadn't found a church. God hadn't opened a door. But we were coming to a place, and my wife and I, it's like, we know we're done. At the end of the summer, at the end of August, we're done and we need to leave even though we don't have a position. And so that was the date. We made it public. We told everyone, hey, we're leaving. Where are you going? We don't know. You know, our stuff moved into the basement of my parents' house, and Rebecca and I and our daughter Erin, who was like 2 at the time, moved into the basement of her parents' house. We had no job, no place to go, no income, and yet I knew that's what God wanted us to do. It was a step of faith. It looked foolish. And there were some people, they looked at us and they just thought, you are nuts. I mean, the youth group was going great in Utah. They said, stay, we don't have anybody. It's like, I'd love to, but I know that's not what God wants. When you listen to God and follow the dream that God's put in your heart, there will be times when you look foolish and people are going to be naysayers and say you're an idiot. But you have to be willing to look foolish. Noah looked foolish building an ark in the plains several hundred miles from water. Sarah looked foolish setting up a nursery and buying maternity clothes at the age of 90. The Israelites looked foolish marching around Jericho blowing trumpets. David looked foolish attacking Goliath with a slingshot. Benaiah looked foolish fighting a lion. The wise men looked foolish, leaving their home to follow a star. Peter looked foolish by stepping out of the boat into the middle of a lake. Jesus looked foolish, hanging on a cross naked. But we know the results of those people's faith, don't we? God saved the world, and Noah was saved from the flood. Sarah had a baby boy. The walls of Jericho came tumbling down. David defeated Goliath. Benaiah killed the lion. The wise men found Jesus. Peter walked on water, and Jesus rose from the dead and accomplished our eternal salvation. Aren't you glad they were willing to look foolish? The reason some of us never kill giants or lions is because we don't want to look foolish. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 27, reading out of the New Living Testament, Paul wrote this to the Corinthian church. He says, God chose the things the world considers foolish in order to shame those who think they're wise. God chooses the foolish things of the world, not the wise things. Why? Because God wants the glory. Our problem is that we're too self-conscious. We're too afraid. What are people going to think about me? But here's the thing. Self-consciousness is part of the curse. Self-consciousness is part of the fall. Before the fall of man in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had no inhibitions. Do you know they wore their birthday suit every day, all day long? That was their attire. They had no inhibitions. But when the fall came, they were naked. They realized they were naked. They were ashamed and they covered themselves up. And ever since the fall, we have been self-conscious. Humankind's been self-conscious. What are people going to think of me? What are they going to say about me? Do I look foolish? How do I come across? I need to say the right thing, do the right thing so that I'm accepted and that people like me. I don't want to look ridiculous. And what we need to do, and in your notes this morning, there's a bullet point. To become like Jesus, we must become less self-conscious and become more God-conscious. We need to become less self-conscious and more God-conscious. Jesus was God-conscious. He didn't care what other people thought about him. He didn't care what the Pharisees thought. He didn't care. Jesus got down, he spit in the mud, and he put it on a guy's eyes, and he prayed for him. I mean, that looks pretty ridiculous, doesn't it? Jesus was willing to heal on the Sabbath, and the Pharisee said, and the priest says, hey, you're working on the Sabbath. You're breaking the law. Jesus didn't care what it appeared like. He listened to God and was willing to look foolish, even to the point of dying for our sin. Spiritual maturity is caring less about what the world thinks about us and caring more about what God thinks about us. Someday, we're going to stand before God, not the world. We're going to stand before God, and God's going to say, what did you do with the dreams that I gave you? What did you do with the things that I tried to nudge you into doing? How did you spend your time? How did you spend your talent? How did you invest your resources? Did you step out of the boat? When I nudge you and says, hey, go, did you step out of the boat? Did you chase the lion? Did you pursue the dreams? Or did you say, man, I don't want to look like a fool? All of us are going to have to give an account to God for the things that he has given to us. We need to be more passionate about pleasing God and looking good to God than we do to people. As Christians, we should be some of the most passionate people on the planet. Not apathetic, not timid, but we should say, God, I want to strive to please you. And if you tell me to take a risk, if you tell me to do something that looks foolish, I want to obey you and follow you. Because here's the thing. God wants us to defy the odds, doesn't he? Isn't that what a lion chaser does? Someone who defies the odds? God defies the odds so we can be willing to look foolish if we're stepping out and being obedient to him. Take a look at 2 Samuel this morning, chapter 23. We're going to take a look at verses 9 and 10. And it's the record of one of David's mighty men. His name was Eliezer. The mighty men of Israel, chapter 23, is kind of like the Israeli army's list of Navy SEALs, okay? I mean, this is the cream of the crop. And one of the guys was named Eliezer. And in verse 9, it says, after him, after the previous Navy SEAL they just mentioned, Eliezer, the son of Dudu. And I'll pause right there. Don't name your kid Dudu. Isn't that a horror? I know that carries probably a different connotation in the Hebrew. But, you know, in the English, Dudu is not a good name. How would you like to, yeah, I'm the son of Dudu. Yeah. Eliezer, the son of Dudu, the Ahoahite. Get this, one of the three mighty men with David when they defied the Philistines who gathered there for battle, and the men of Israel had retreated. Did you just pick up about this? David is ready to fight the Philistines. He has his whole army, and everyone except three Navy SEALs get chicken and go home. Okay, I don't know about you, but when everyone's leaving, and there's only three of you against an army, the three of you and your captain against an army, doesn't it look foolish to stay there? Yeah, that looks pretty foolish, but not this guy. So he was willing to look foolish, but he takes it a step further. Verse 10, he arose and attacked the Philistines until his hand was weary and his hand stuck to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day. And I love this. And the people returned after him only to plunder. All the guys who left, now they come back for the victory. Now they come back for the spoils of war. Now they come back for the riches. They weren't willing to take a risk and be foolish and step out, but now they want the blessing. You know what's sad is that a lot of people miss out on the blessings of God because they're not willing to look foolish. But here in Eliezer, we see he did step six, but also there's something else. And this is definition number 7 of verse faith. If you're taking notes this morning, faith fights until your hand freezes to the sword. Faith fights until your hand freezes to the sword. Eliezer didn't care that there was only four of them. He attacked until his hand was weary. That was a pivot point right there. He's attacking till his hand is weary. And here's the thing. What does he do? Does he say, you know what? I'm quitting. I'm giving up. No, it says, and his hand stuck to the sword. It froze to the sword. He said, I'm going to keep fighting. And I can guarantee this. Up to now, we've been talking a lot about how do we start the process of chasing a lion. Number 7, once you start chasing the lion, the dream that God gives you, I guarantee you're going to get weary. I guarantee you're going to encounter problems, obstacles in the midst of chasing the lion. And what are you going to do? I have seen so many people, the dream they have when they get tired, when they get weary, when they don't see victory, when they just see Philistine after Philistine keep coming at them, and they're fighting away, and they don't see God answering prayer. They don't see any deliverance on the horizon. They finally say, you know what? I'm done with this. And they throw the sword down and they walk away. And they give up on the dream, the lion they've been chasing. But Eliezer was different. His hand froze to the sword and he said, I'm going to keep going. I will not quit. I will keep fighting. And that's what we need. We need to keep fighting for the dreams that God gives us. How do you keep fighting when you're weary? How do you go on when you feel it's useless, when you feel that the onslaught, the enemy keeps coming, that the problems continue to arise, that you don't see any deliverance? How do you keep going? In your notes this morning, when you're weary, take one step at a time. Take one step at a time. That's how we keep fighting. We just take another step. And then you take another step. You don't worry about the last step. You just worry about the step in front of you. Dreams are a lot like a box of Legos. Okay? We've got a slide here This is a picture of a box of Legos. And the thing is, a lot of times we want our dreams, we want to open up the box and boom, out pops the robot or the character, whatever it is. This is from the series Exo-Force. I have no idea what it is. It was my son's. He doesn't play with Legos anymore. He's in college. But he says, yeah, Dad, you can take this. He had this assembled. Thank goodness I didn't have to put it together. But this is, God speaks to us. He gives us a dream. We say, yes, God, I'll step out. And you know what we want to happen? Boom! Ta-da! There it is. It's done. It's finished. But you know what? There are 160 pieces to this Lego robot. And you know how you build the dream? The vision that God gave you that you saw on the box top? One brick at a time. One Lego at a time. And the way that you and I chase the lion, chase the dream, build the dream that God has given us is one step at a time. How do you get in shape? One workout at a time. How do you get the promotion at work? One project at a time. How do you get the music scholarship? One rehearsal at a time. That's how we chase the lion in our lives. It is one step at a time. And when we get weary, just do the next thing that God told you to do. And if you don't know what it, you just keep doing it. Keep doing, keep going the direction that God spoke to you about. Don't quit. Don't give up. Eliezer, one more swipe, one more enemy, one more Philistine, one more attack. And he just kept fighting, and he kept fighting. His hand kept freezing to the sword. He's weary, but he doesn't care. And finally, after who knows how long, it doesn't tell us, there's no more enemy. And now there's all this plunder all around him. And he's a rich man. Not only rich in wealth, but now in the influence that God gave him. He becomes one of the mighty men of Israel. I don't think he was a mighty man at the time, but I think because of that act, he was elevated. Yeah, you're now one of the elite. You're one of the lion chasers. You're one of the dream catchers. Because he wouldn't quit fighting. On July 2nd, 1863, Joshua Chamberlain and his 300-soldier regiment were all that stood between the Confederates and the Union Army at a certain defeat at the battlefield of Gettysburg. At 2:30 p.m., the Confederate Army charged, and Chamberlain and his 300 soldiers held the charge, and then there was a second charge and they held, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, and they held. And at the end of the fifth charge, there were only 80 Union soldiers left at Little Round Top Hill. Chamberlain himself had been knocked to the ground by a bullet that hit his belt buckle. He fell to the ground. He got back up, and he was a 34-year-old school teacher from Maine that entered into the military. And one of his sergeants told him, hey, there's no reinforcements coming, and we're down to our last round of ammunition. And the 4,000 Confederate soldiers are getting ready to mount another charge. There's a little 12-year-old boy posted as a lookout on the tree, and he says, they're getting ready to charge. And Chamberlain realizes he has only one option, and he says, we need to attack. So 80 men, led by a bayonet charge, charge the Confederates instead of them charging them. And you know what happened? In 5 minutes, 4,000 Confederate soldiers surrendered. Historians tell us that in full view of the enemy, Chamberlain climbed onto a barricade of stones. He gave a command. He pointed his spear at the army, and he yelled, charge. And they believe if he had not charged, the South would have gained the high ground, and there's a good chance they would have won the Battle of Gettysburg and the entire Civil War. One man, when the odds looked impossible, he said, I'm not going to quit the fight. I'm not going to surrender. I'm not going to wave the white flag. Charge. And God accomplished a great victory that day. He said at the end of his life, Chamberlain said, he went on to become the governor of Maine, but he said, I knew I may die, but I also knew I was not going to die with a bullet in my back. I have within me the inability to do nothing. Friends, when you're weary, when you're down to the end of your rope, don't do nothing. Take one more step. Take another step. Keep fighting. Let your hand freeze to the sword. Those are the seven keys to faith. Now, I want to close with a final observation, and it's there in your notes. And this is something so many times we don't realize. The dream that God gives us, the lion we're chasing, is not just for you. God always does what he does for the future generations. He always does it for the future generations. And our actions or inactions have a ripple effect. Many times we think the dream is about us. It's about our lives, how it immediately affects us. But the dreams God plants in our heart are usually acorns that grow up into mighty oak trees that span the years and live way past the time that we live. Joseph had this dream of being a great leader. He didn't realize that by saving his family, his father Jacob, and the other 12 sons of Israel, that he was saving the 12 tribes of Israel through whom Jesus would be born and come and save the world. Paul didn't realize that when God gives him this dream of planting churches among the Gentiles, and then he's writing letters to those churches, that that dream would span 2,000 years. Those letters would be assembled into the Bible. It'd be preached around the world, and the impact to the Gentiles would save millions of Gentiles, not just those small congregations that he planted in the first century. The dreams that God gives span sometimes decades, even centuries or millennia. You don't know how powerful the dream God is planting in your heart. I'm going to close with this story. There was a man named Edward Kimball. Most of us have never heard of him. He was a Sunday school teacher of teenage boys in the 1850s. And he had a dream that each boy in his class had become a follower of Jesus Christ. He not only taught the class and taught God's learned word, taught the lesson, but he decided he would be intentional with every last single boy and do all that he could. He would pray and seek out each one until they came to know Jesus. There was one of his students, a 17-year-old, who had no interest in matters of spirituality. He had moved to the Boston area and was living with family. His uncle said, you can live with us if you go to church with us. Like a lot of kids, he was forced to go to church. And so this student went, no interest in God or spirituality. And one day, Kimball went to the Boston shoe shop where this young man worked, and he came up to him and says, I'm worried about you. Can we talk? And the young man said, yeah. So they went down into the basement stock room of the shoe store, and there Kimball talked to him about Jesus, about his need for salvation, and just poured his heart out. And the young man didn't get saved there, but he fell under conviction. And he eventually gave his life to Jesus Christ. The young man's name, D.L. Moody. D.L. Moody became an evangelist who shared the gospel. He touched two continents, and he shared the gospel with 100 million people, with thousands coming to Jesus Christ. And that was in the days before technology, before radio, before television, before the internet. It's just, I go to a crusade, people come. He shared the gospel with 100 million people because of a Sunday school teacher. But you know what? The story doesn't stop there. In one of Moody's crusades, a young man named Wilbur Chapman came, And he was mightily impacted. He had doubted his salvation, just really was doing nothing for God. He was even in the ministry, and there Moody ministered to him one-on-one, and he got an assurance of salvation. He went on to become a great evangelist, seeing thousands of Jesus come to, thousands of people come to Jesus. But the story continues to ripple. In one of his meetings, a baseball player had some time off, and he went to the meeting. He was convicted of his sin, and the baseball player became a Christian, and that baseball player's name was Billy Sunday. If you ever heard of Billy Sunday, he played for a few professional baseball teams, and Billy Sunday eventually left baseball, and he became an evangelist, and he went around America preaching Jesus Christ. One of the crusades he did was in Charlotte, North Carolina. And out of that crusade, there rose a group of Christians, people who had gotten saved, and they start an organization, and they begin praying for revival and trying to do meetings and crusades to try to have their city come to Christ. And in one of those meetings, they invited an evangelist named Mordecai Ham. And Mordecai Ham, he comes, and he's going to do this revival, and he's discouraged. The night before the revival, October 8th, 1934, he writes a note to his wife, and he says, "Lord, give us Pentecost here. Pour out your spirit tomorrow." At that meeting, a sandy-haired, lanky high schooler named Billy Frank, as his family called him, he said, "I'm not going to go hear him preach," but a bunch of his friends says, "We're going to go to the meetings. We're going to disrupt them. We're going to have a great time messing this up." And Billy says, I want to see that. So he goes and he sits in the back. And as he's sitting there, he's hearing the things that are being preached, and he's interested. He comes back the next night, and he gives his life to Jesus Christ. He responds to the invitation, and he's converted. Billy Frank, who we know today as Billy Graham, got saved. And since then, as of 2008, Billy Graham's estimated lifetime audience, including radio and television broadcast, topped 2.2 billion with a B. Not million, but billion people, with millions of souls coming to Jesus Christ. I want you to think about back to those 1800s when a Sunday school teacher had a dream, a lion. I want to see every one of those teenage boys come to Jesus Christ. If he wouldn't have chased that lion, how many millions, maybe billions of people through the decades would have been lost, died, and gone to hell? Friends, your dream is not about you. It's about the generations to come. It's about the second and the third and the fourth and the fifth and who knows how long till Jesus carries. You don't know, but maybe your dream and your dream influences the next Billy Graham. Maybe your dream and your dream inspires the next Joyce Meyer. Maybe your dream and your dream, maybe that's the one that propels the next Toby Mac or Craig Rochelle or Beth Moore or Priscilla Schreier or who knows, the next Chuck Swindoll. You don't know the lives God wants to impact through the ripple effect of your dream.
You have been listening to the podcast of Casper Faith Assembly in Casper, Wyoming. For more information, please email us casperfaith@gmail.com or call us at 307-265-9121. We hope you've enjoyed this presentation of Casper Faith Assembly, where relationships matter most.